I'm Karen Hartglass. How are you doing today? It is December 17, 2013, and it's a cold one here in New York City. We've had a nice dusting. The sky is white, and I like it. It's refreshing, especially when you're sitting inside looking outside through the window. Okay, weather is really interesting, especially when we think about what we're doing to impact the weather today and if we are indeed having an impact on the weather. There's all those conversations about global warming and all the things we're doing to the environment. And there's something else going on in the world that we need to be talking about. I know everybody listening on this show talks about genetically modified organisms, and we're going to be spending quite a bit of time in the next half hour with Brett Wilcox, who's the author of We're Monsanto, Feeding the World Lie After Lie. He's a hubby, father, licensed professional counselor, and not quite over-the-hill vegan runner. He and his 15-year-old cross-country champion son, David, will run across the United States in 2014 while his wife, Chris, and daughter, Olivia, crew for them. They are running for a GMO-free USA. And they have a website, runningthecountry.com. We'll find out more about that in a moment. Welcome to It's All About Food, Brett.
Thank you, Karen. It's so good to be here with you.
Oh, gosh. You know, it's a funny thing. I really believe that if we pay attention, the universe will direct us to places we need to go and people we need to meet. And the universe did just that. I was looking for people to have on my program, and I found you and your book. And I was really delighted to find out all about you and what you're doing.
The delight is mutual.
Yeah. So you wrote this book, and we're going to talk a bit about that. So basically, you have you've listed a number of different items that are about Monsanto, and you're actually calling them lies. In your book.
Yes, that's correct.
And then you discuss them. So my first question is, how is it you get away with doing that in a book, and how come Monsanto hasn't come after you?
Well, I think the way I get away with doing it is just by making sure that everything I write is thoroughly documented and researched, and make sure that I believe that everything that I am writing is the truth. If I were to write something and intentionally misrepresent my beliefs or misrepresent what I think is the truth, I think that could be a problem. But as long as I stick with what I perceive to be the facts from the research that I've dug up, then I think I'm on safe legal ground there. As far as why hasn't Monsanto done anything about it, you know, I think at this point I am a very, very small mosquito in a world where there are millions of people who oppose Monsanto. We know we've had two global marches against Monsanto just in this last year. I am just one of millions, and if Monsanto was to go out and rebut what we are all doing, they would do nothing but that. So they would have no time left. I do believe if I ever get to the point where I'm more than a small mosquito and our run attracts more attention, it may behoove Monsanto at that point to weigh the pros and the cons of whether they're going to address what we're doing or not. And we'll see how that plays out.
I like the analogy to a mosquito, because a mosquito is very small and can be very annoying.
Yes, that's true.
And can get a lot of attention. And it's so important for us to all realize that we are not insignificant. The work that we do, everything that we do is important. And if you ever think that it's not, just think of a little mosquito in your room when you're trying to go to sleep.
Boy, that's for sure.
That little mosquito can really make a point. And
yes.
if that's why mosquitoes are here, to make us realize how significant each individual is, well, then maybe that's the good thing about mosquitoes, because I don't know what else they're good for. All right. Let's dig into some of these lies, shall we?
You bet.
Right. So I've got a big stack of pages here. How many lies are in this book?
50 lies, and this is the first book.
lies to come.
Yeah, there's 50 more that are almost done. It's almost ready to be published right now.
Great. Well, okay. I think it's the first one, but Monsanto lets us know that They're really in this business to do good for the world, make the world a better place, and feed all the hungry. And I know a lot of people that have heard that and believe it. But it's not really true, is it?
The most dangerous lie that Monsanto tells is the lie that we believe. And this is the deal that they have going on at Monsanto. They take a natural food and then they inject it with a bacteria or virus or something. They do something to it that nobody wants, virtually no one wants, except for the shareholders. Absolutely no one needs, and then they saturate it with poison or two or three different poisons, and then they give it to the marketing team and they say, sell this. So imagine yourself being on the marketing team when you get this stuff that nobody wants, nobody needs, and it's saturated with poison, and you have to market that. And so the marketing team knows that telling people that these things aren't all that bad and it doesn't cause cancer all that often and your kids aren't going to have birth defects all that often and it's not really all that bad for the environment and not all of the butterflies are going to die, not all of the bees are going to die, that wouldn't sell anything. And so you have to go to the opposite extreme in order to get people to buy into this product. And they know what people want. People are good-hearted, and they want everyone on the earth to be able to be fed and to be able to be satisfied with the food that they have. And so they take that, and they exploit that. And they show us pictures of poor Africans who are starving to death, and then they reinforce the message again and again and again, saying that if we don't do this, that millions or possibly billions of people will die. So we've gone from something that nobody wants, nobody needs, and it's saturated with poison to, well, we need to do this because if we don't do it, look at all the billions of people who will die. And they sell that lie so effectively that good-hearted people buy the lie and they say, yeah, we need to do this. We need GMOs because that's the only way we can keep up with the world's population growth.
Now, I don't want to believe that everyone that works for Monsanto believes that they're lying. I think that there are some people that work for Monsanto and for other companies that are making genetically modified organisms for food and for other things, that they think that they are doing something good. I know I've met certain scientists that work for Monsanto or for DuPont or Syngenta, and they really believe that they're doing something good. It's hard to believe that, you know, they're all evil over there.
No,
but I think they might be.
And I wouldn't want to suggest that.
Yeah.
I do recall a man, and I've forgotten his name now, but he bought into the stories that Monsanto tells, and he hired on, and I think he was going on to work in marketing or sales, and he got in there, and the president or CEO at the time had said some great things, and in a speech, and this man says, "Wow, wasn't that speech amazing?" And his coworkers took him aside, and he says, "Don't listen to that. That's what we tell the public. We don't even understand what he's talking about." So at a certain level, yeah, there are people that buy into it and they hire on it and they do believe into it and they are good-hearted people. Of course, you got to be good-hearted because you do believe you've got a positive product to produce and to sell and it is necessary. But when you get to a certain point and you read the data, you read the research, and you see that the biodiversity and small-scale farming really does do better, perhaps not in yield per acre, but certainly in health per acre, in nutrition per acre. And you see that the fewer resources are used. You see that more people are employed and that the food is healthier. It's not saturated with poison. When you get to that point, yeah, it does come down to out-and-out lying.
Okay, so I'm not a fan of genetically modified food, and I'm don't know if it's safe, and I have a feeling that there are probably some health issues that are connected to it, and I know it impacts the environment in a negative way. I believe all those things. But I just want to say that because we haven't had enough or really any studies that connect the impact on genetically modified food with long-term human health, let's just assume for a moment that it doesn't create a problem. I think it does, but let's assume it doesn't. There are so many other things that are wrong with using genetically modified plants in the environment, and I just wanted to highlight some of them because I think it's important for people to realize this, because people are screaming that we don't know if these things are safe for consumption, but there are so many other things that are that matter. For example, genetically modified food encourages all the wrong things in our current agricultural system. It encourages the use of too many pesticides and herbicides. It encourages not rotating fields and regenerating the life and the necessary organisms and health and nutrients inside the soil. It doesn't encourage the use of, well, let me just say, it encourages using monocrops. And when you're growing the same thing, field after field after field after field after field, you're encouraging viruses and poor health in the soil and wreaking havoc on all kinds of life. And all of those things aren't good. And we, even though that's given us a great deal of efficiency in industrial agriculture, we're now seeing the impact, how it's devastating our topsoil, and the food that we're growing isn't nutritious.
Exactly.
And then, okay, now then on top of all of that, let's add to the potential that it's dangerous for us to eat these foods.
Right.
We've got a nightmare.
Right. I'm sure you've heard the stories that Howard Vlieger and other farmers tell, how they farmers have placed a conventional cob of corn on a tree, tacked it there or nailed it there next to a GMO cob of corn, and they leave it there for the squirrels to eat it. And the squirrels do eat the conventional ear of corn, but they don't touch the GMO corn. And Howard, on a first-name basis, he talks to farmers who have either intentionally conducted that experiment or unintentionally by leaving a GMO sack in the barn over the winter next to a conventional sack and going out in the spring and discovering that the conventional sack is gone and the GMO corn still sits there. And so animals don't need double-blind placebo studies the way we scientists and humans do. They just somehow know that GMO is not food.
And it's funny how they don't need labels.
That's true. They don't need labels. And Mother Nature cannot read labels. And so, you know, we talk about having the GMO corn next to the conventional corn, and Mother Nature, you know, the bees come along and they're going to pollinate one way or the other back and forth, and things get contaminated, and that's going to be, that is another one of the really damning truths about GMOs. Once these things are released or unleashed into the environment, they continue to grow and spread. Chemical pollution, chemical contamination, always dissipates over time, but biological pollution in the form of GMOs spreads and gets bigger. And we have no idea what the long-term effects are going to be upon the environment. Nobody knows that. Scientists couldn't possibly say they know that. We do know that we are a piece of the web of life. And when we mess around with the web of life the way we are doing with genetically modified organisms, we are really placing ourselves at great risk.
So you've got 50 lies in this book, and each one of them is pretty intense. I think we should talk about a few of them.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. One that comes to mind is what we've done in Iraq.
Yes. That's one that really doesn't even get much coverage from people such as myself, who really believe strongly that the GMO is not the way to go. Many people still don't know that there is such a thing as Order 81. And when you get online and you Google Order 81 and Google Iraq, and you see how the U.S. government played hand-in-hand with Monsanto. And Monsanto went in on the coattails of the U.S. military, and Order 81 said that the Iraqi seed was unstable, ununiform, and unsafe, or something like that, and they said that the farmers needed to start growing genetically modified seed, and that's what Order 81 is, and that shows really the extent that Monsanto is wrapped up in the U.S. government and in military affairs, and how the FDA and the U.S. government are almost the same organization, and beyond the FDA, the State Department that goes out and actively promotes Monsanto with Monsanto DVDs and brochures. And it's as if the State Department is the marketing arm of Monsanto.
Mm. And did the farmers know that they had to pay for the seeds every year?
It is my understanding that the seeds were given to them out of benevolence the first year or two.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then,
the first
then later.
Was free.
Yes. Yeah, like a drug dealer. Yeah, that's correct.
Mm. Now, another scary thing about genetically modified organisms and the way our law works today is that, okay, it's bad enough that Monsanto and DuPont and Syngenta and whoever else is involved in this, it's bad enough that they're growing fields, test crops, or approved crops of genetically modified plants. But there's no protection with the pollen that floats in the air from those plants that can pollinate and contaminate conventional plants. And some of those plants are even organic plants. And then the seeds from those contaminated organic plants can accidentally be grown on a plot of land that's considered organic, and lo and behold, you have a genetically modified plant. And that farmer can actually be sued for not paying for the patent rights to use those seeds.
Yes. That has been the case up until this last summer when Jim Gerritsen with the Organic Seed Growers and Trade Association, that they filed a lawsuit against Monsanto for the contamination issue, and they got a partial victory stating that Monsanto could no longer sue farmers for inadvertent contamination. They have been doing it for years, but that's changed evidently. But regardless,
That's good news.
Yes, it is. The patent issue is just absurd because the Monsanto and the other biotech companies, the other chemical giants, they reap all the benefits of the patent, but they assume none of the liabilities of the patent. It's the organic and conventional farmers that reap the liabilities. And when these farmers go to the USDA and say, hey, you approved this, we need compensation, the mm-hmm. USDA's response is buy insurance. I have a good friend in Oregon, a farmer, and he told me that he had to plow under his Swiss chard. And I said, Swiss chard? What are you talking about? There's no GMO Swiss chard. And he said, Brett, they were planting GMO sugar beets next to my Swiss chard, and they are so closely related that contamination would have happened. And he couldn't take the risk of being contaminated because once you're contaminated, you go from being able to get top dollar for your crop to getting significantly less because people obviously want to pay top dollar for non-GMO food. And who paid for that? Well, he did. You know, even though the government approves it, and even though these chemical giants produce this stuff, they're not having to pay for this. These farmers that are having to plow under their crops to avoid contamination, or the farmers who find themselves who are no longer organic. They've lost their organic certification, which is an expensive procedure in and of itself and takes years to get back, and they're just out of luck.
And we just need to buy insurance.
Yeah, that's the government's response.
Oh, gosh. Excuse me. Out of these 50 lies, do you have a favorite?
Well, for me, I tend to want to focus on the lies that people are most prone to believe. You know, there's a lot of lies in there about Prop 37, and those lies were recycled, with I-522 in Washington this last year with the same results. The chemical giants were able to defeat the labeling of GMOs in both states now. But to me, the worst lies are the lies that really get into the good hearts of Americans, and we believe them. And my favorite lie might be a lie that's coming out in book two, and that's the lie involving golden rice, because the lie is that rice, if we can supplement rice with vitamin A, if we can inject rice with vitamin A, that it will save 50,000 kids a month from going blind. And of course, who wouldn't want that sort of thing?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another one of those lies that opens the door to the whole host of monoculture, corrupt, political, environmental mess type of agriculture that is what the chemical giants are doing on our farmlands. And so I tend to focus on that, because those are the things that people need to be most careful of. It's the lies that get into their hearts and make them pause and say, wait a minute, maybe this thing isn't so bad after all.
I want to talk a little bit about golden rice. And one of the things that people don't realize when it comes to genetically modified food is that most people are hungry because they don't have money. They're extremely
right.
poor. They don't
right.
have land to grow food on.
Right.
Or they're living on land that has been so degraded that they can't grow on, or they don't have enough water, or they have too much water. And these are the issues that impact these people. And when you think about it, genetically modified foods can't help them.
No, they can't. Golden rice is the first.
If we really want to help people, we need to help them grow food, and that means land has to be made available. The land needs to be nurtured, and I'm a big believer in knowledge and technology. I think there are some good things about technology, some not so good things, but we can take all the things that we've learned and take them to people who need them, and we can show people how to nourish their soil, how to enrich it with nutrients,
right.
and they can grow, for the most part, things that are native in their area and
right.
nourish themselves from those
right.
plants that want to be there. And they talk about bringing in golden rice, which is supposed to supply these poor children with vitamin A, a necessary nutrient. Well, why can't they just grow the crops that are native there that would naturally want to grow, and show them how to nourish their land and find ways to make them do what nature wants to do in those locations instead of creating
yeah.
this frankenfood?
Yes, so beautifully stated. We learned from Tufts University was conducting research on golden rice in China. And they'd gone in there to do research to see whether it really did have the vitamin A that they were talking about, and see whether it had a measurable difference with the kids. The thing is, the GM rice, the golden rice, was so sensitive, it was considered too sensitive to tell the subjects that that's what they were being tested with.
Mm.
And when that came out, and the misuse of ethics involved in that, the study was shut down. So imagine that we're presenting a solution to people, but we don't even dare tell them what the solution is because it's too sensitive. Or in other words, it's just too offensive. People don't even want to consider that. They don't want to go there. And yet they're trying to sell that to the world as the solution that's going to solve blindness. I mean, you can't even tell the subjects that that's what they're being tested with. It's absurd. And it's not the rice that needs to be modified. It's the political and economic systems that need to be modified.
Yeah, amen to that. Oh, Brett, so let's talk about some good things. You've decided to run. And this is you have a video, and I watched it. And where can people watch your Running the Country video?
Yeah, we right now, my son and I are running across America starting January 18th from Huntington Beach in California, and we have a fundraising campaign that's live right now. It's at Indiegogo.com, and Indy is I-N-D-I-E, Indiegogo.com, and you type in GMOs in the Indiegogo search bar, and you'll see a list of campaigns that come up, including ours. You'll see a picture of me and my son, and the name of the campaign is Running for a GMO-Free USA. When you click on that link, it takes you to our campaign video, the video does a great job of explaining the run and why my son is so passionate about running across America and where the roots of that came from, as well as the mission, and that is the GMO-free USA and GMO-free world mission that we're embarking on.
Well, I really enjoyed the video. It was very well done, and it's really inspiring to see young people talking so intelligently and showing their concern for the future of our planet. And sometimes we have to look to young people because the older people seem to forget. what's important.
Yes.
Somehow we get numb to the real essential things that matter.
So well stated. My son's been a vegetarian for years, and he sensed some things about life and the sacred nature of life earlier than I did, and he led me along the path, and now he's going to be leading me down the road. He's a cross country champion runner, and I'm a 52-year-old man who hopes that I can tie a rope to him and keep up with him.
You know, when I contacted you, I didn't know you were vegan.
I am vegan, have been vegan for a year and a half. The rest of my family is vegetarian.
Okay, well, congratulations, and thank you for that. Now, I'm a vegan for over 25 years and a vegetarian for longer, and on this program I do promote eating a plant-based diet and talk to a lot of different people about the benefits of plant foods. So
it
was just, you know, an extra bonus when I contacted you, because I had no idea what your food choices were, because not everyone that is against genetically modified foods chooses to not eat meat.
That is true. Whatever, you know, the cool thing about this issue is that regardless of what our food choices are, I don't know that there's any group out there that would say, yeah, GMOs are the answer to me. That's what I need to sustain my body, and that's what I hope other people eat. Nobody is saying that. We're all on the same page when it comes to GMOs.
I'm trying to think if I knew anybody that was saying, yeah, give me a big bowl of genetically modified food.
Nobody's ever gone to the store in search of GMOs.
Excuse me?
Nobody has ever gone to the store to buy GMOs.
But, you know, they have gone to the store to buy foods that are inexpensive.
Yes.
And when foods aren't labeled, and maybe even if they were labeled genetically modified, I think a lot of people would go for the cheaper price.
Well, the cheaper price and inexpensive is really an illusion. Those cheaper prices are there because the very foods that we shouldn't be eating are subsidized throughout the food system, the agricultural system. We heavily subsidize the chemical giants and the huge agribusiness farms. We subsidize what they produce so that it can be sold cheaply to the dairy and meat industry, so they can produce what they do very cheaply, and that's subsidized. And so it looks cheap on the grocery store shelf, but it is not cheap. We've paid for it several times through our taxes, and we will pay through it several times through our insurance as well.
You know, I didn't mention this before, but when I was talking about all the things that are wrong about growing genetically modified food that aren't connected to whether they're dangerous to consume or not, I think you mentioned it in the book, but most of the foods that are grown that are genetically modified, soy and alfalfa, they're used to feed animals.
Yes.
And they support this habit we have here in the United States and more in other countries of consuming too many animals.
Yeah, a fraction of our corn and soy is actually fed to human beings. Most of it is fed to cars in the form of ethanol that poor people can't drive, and a good share of it is fed to livestock that poor people can't afford to eat. So the whole idea that Monsanto and the chemical giants are producing food to feed the world's poor doesn't play out, because it's feeding an agricultural system that's wasteful. Both the ethanol and the livestock industry is extremely wasteful, and we could feed two or three times the Earth's population with what we're currently producing if we actually grew healthy food and ate it directly instead of feeding it to cars and animals.
Well, I like the idea of not relying on foreign sources for energy, especially foreign oil. But I don't think most people realize that it takes quite a bit of energy to make ethanol from corn, and it's really an inefficient process, and it really doesn't have a lot of benefit.
No, it huge environmental costs involved in ethanol.
So other than running across the country, what should we be doing?
I love that question, because people say, "Well, Brett, we can't all run across the country," and that's true, and not everybody has that desire or interest. And my answer to that is, you know, find your calling, find your mission. if you feel that this is an important issue, whether you feel it is or not, it is, because we all eat food. But find what your mission is and find out how to best share that. I believe that the reason we're able to that we have any level of awareness today is because of the internet. That has taken away the control that the media has over our minds. We can go to the internet and we can Google Order 81 and all the other things related to Monsanto and the chemical industry. And so with the access to that information, we are then free to say, wow, this is amazing. We can talk to our grandmothers. We can share. We can like. We can tweet. There are many musicians who have made songs about this and put it out on the internet. And so whether you read or write or speak or paint or make music, whatever it is, find the way that appeals to you, that calls you, and make a difference according to the way it works out for you.
Right. And, of course, if we want to avoid consuming them, the best thing to do is buy organic.
That is absolutely the best and safest thing.
Grow your own.
Yes. Yes, which would be organic at home, yes.
Right, because even though there is no labeling, when you get a food that's labeled organic that has that little code, that five-digit code that starts with a 9, meaning organic, you'll know that
right.
It's not genetically modified.
Right.
Wow. Well, Brett, I can't wait to read part 2. When is that coming out?
Well, the goal is to have it out before the next March Against Monsanto, which is May 24th of 2014. I only have a few more lies to finish up to have that book done, but I'm not going to make any promises because we are going to be on the road and we're going to be speaking to people as often as possible, getting the word out there as often as possible. And I feel like we may want to emphasize the run because we have 7 months on the road, which is a huge opportunity to draw media attention, both for the, you know, there's many platforms here that are just speak for media attention. The fact that my son is going to be the second youngest person to ever do this run. We're the first father and teen to ever do this run. He just turned 15 in November.
Wow. Do you have a map of where you're going?
We have a more or less map, and I haven't placed it on the internet, but we're starting in Southern California, and we're going along Route 66-ish,
mm-hmm.
and we'll be turning up towards St. Louis, and we'll be definitely going through St. Louis because that's the headquarters of Monsanto, and we'll also hit D.C. because that's the other headquarters of Monsanto.
Mm. Very good. Well, I hope to see you somewhere along the way.
That would be wonderful.
And it really is a good thing you're doing because I'm sure a lot of my listeners are pretty tuned in about what's going on with genetically modified food, but most people aren't. We do not have enough media or we don't have enough information in our faces on a regular basis talking about whether they're good or bad. Nobody's talking
right.
about it.
Right.
We need
most
to be having
are,
this conversation
you know,
a lot.
Exactly, yes.
Well, Brett, I want to thank you so much for joining me today on It's All About Food, and people can visit runningthecountry.com and go to that Indiegogo site if you want to help support them in their project to run the country.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, are you motivated to do something like run across the country to stand up for something that you believe in? What are you inspired to do to stand up for what you believe in? It's really something when we see what some people are doing, and we all need to do more. I keep thinking I got to do more. And what I'm going to do right now is take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to relax and talk about some delicious food with Chef Del Sroof, who's got a new cookbook called Better Than Vegan. Believe it or not, Better Than Vegan. So we'll be right back. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. We're back with It's All About Food on a very cold and chilly and wet December 17, 2013 here in New York City. Gosh, it's looking pretty dreary outside, but that's good. I like change, and I'm sure that we need the snow for one reason or another. So I'm just not going to resist. I am going to put on my warm clothes when I go out and enjoy it. Now we're going to bring on Chef Del Shroof, who has a new cookbook out called Better Than Vegan, 101 Favorite Low-Fat Plant-Based Recipes That Helped Me, meaning Del, lose over 200 pounds. Del Shroof has worked in vegan and vegetarian kitchens for more than 23 years, most recently as chef and co-owner of the Wellness Forum Foods, a plant-based meal delivery and catering service that emphasizes health, minimally processed foods. He teaches cooking classes and is the lead author of the best-selling cookbook, Forks Over Knives, the cookbook. He has also contributed recipes to Food Over Medicine by Dr. Pam Popper and Glenn Mertzer. Welcome, Del. Welcome back to
Karen,
All About
thank
Food.
Thank you for having me back. Good to be with you.
Yeah, so first I wanted to tell you, do you know where I am today?
Well, I know that it's cold there. It's not much warmer here, by the way.
I'm sitting in Linda Long's home.
Linda, I love her. Tell her I said hello.
Yeah, she was very excited when I said I was going to be talking to you.
So I've never had that opportunity. I want to sit in Linda Long's home.
Well, if you do come here sometime, she'll make you some really wonderful soup. So I just want people
that.
To know, Linda Long's been on my show before. She's the author of Great Chefs Cook Vegan, a groundbreaking book where all of these highly renowned chefs, conventional chefs, cooked vegan, presented lovely vegan meals in her cookbook, Great Chef Cook Vegan, and then she came out with Virgin Vegan, and your baked tofu recipe is in her Virgin Vegan.
That's right. Yes, it is.
That's right.
I got to test a recipe for her Great Chef Cook Vegan recipe. It's a gorgeous cookbook.
It is a gorgeous cookbook, and it's also in French.
Ah, mais oui.
Ah, mais oui, parce qu'il faut avoir un livre comme ça en français.
Vraiment, vraiment.
So anyway, we're having a little vegan love fest here, and I just wanted to let you know that. And if you came here, what I wanted to say is I'm sure Linda would make you a lovely soup. She made me a energized kale soup today that was very, very nice.
Very good.
All right, Del, you have a story.
More than one, but yeah, one big one.
A big story. So let's just get a review of that, because I think people's eyes pop wide open when they hear things like this.
I think the most amazing thing that really surprised people, you know, I was vegan back in 1997, and by the year 2001, I had gained over 200 pounds. Now, I can't blame the vegan diet per se, but I can blame the kind of vegan diet that I was on. I ate a lot of high-fat foods and processed foods, and there's several foods that you don't even really think about. You know, beer is vegan, potatoes can be vegan, donuts can be vegan, avocados are vegan and full of fat. Lots of concentrated calories, and it added up pretty quickly for a guy that was already a big guy.
Right.
So I weighed over 475 pounds at one point, and I did it pretty much on a strictly vegan diet.
Wow. I'm just like, how do you get around you have all of that to bring around with you?
Well, I am a strong guy.
Yeah, you do develop a lot of muscle. That's true.
Get a lot of muscle going on there. But, you know, it was actually hard. I remember in 2001 I had a vegan bakery. I closed it because I was exhausted, of course, and I started a personal chef service. But I remember I would get up in the morning and cook for 2 hours and then go and sit down for an hour, go and lay down for an hour. And that was my life.
Wow.
And so, you know, it was a very difficult life. And the funny thing is it sort of creeps up on you. You realize, you don't realize that you're doing less and less, that you're less social, you're less out in the world. I wasn't exercising like I used to. I wasn't doing any of the things that I used to do. And then all of a sudden one day I realized all I did was sit and watch TV when I wasn't working. I was recovering from being overweight.
Now, you found Dr. Pam Popper.
Mm-hmm.
And between the two of you, you got on her plan for food, and you lost a whole bunch of weight.
I did. I lost over 200. I've lost the 200 that I put on.
And how long did that take?
The first 200 pounds came off pretty easily. I'd say I did it slowly, so it took me about 3 years, 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of it's coming off a little more slowly. One thing you have to remember is that losing weight is about 70% diet, and then the rest of it's exercise. So I've had to really kick into the exercise. I'm in the gym with a trainer 4 days a week now, and I'm losing about a pound and a half a week.
Wow.
So I think in the next 4 or 5 months, I'll be down to my ideal weight and a much happier guy.
Oh, I can't wait to see the photos.
They'll be out there, I promise.
Now, when you're very large, over 400 pounds, can you exercise? Can you move around once you decide you want to be on a path to lose weight? When can you start to really move?
Well, if you work with a good trainer, I did start exercising some 6 years ago, but I had to go at the pace that my body could handle it. And in fact, what started the whole thing in the first place is I fell, and I broke a bone in my foot, and it just wasn't going to heal. So I actually started just doing as little as possible. So, you know, I did more stationary bike than actually walking up and down stairs or a treadmill kind of activity, more upper body weight training, and you just slowly add to that as you can. Just recently I added fitness boxing to the mix, and it's really been amazing the difference it makes in terms of not only weight loss but my energy.
Mm. Okay, well, this is all very inspiring. Now, there's another piece here, and then I want to get to the cookbook. But the other piece about weight is there are emotional issues.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we don't just put on weight. There are reasons behind it, and I think we're all individuals, and everybody's got their own story. But clearly, you have to address those emotional issues, too.
Yeah, in fact, I teach classes now to help others do just that very thing, because it was a sort of a big light that came on when one day I sat down with a therapist because I was just tired and depressed, and we started digging into all of that. And it's pretty amazing how strong the emotional drive for eating can be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you've used eating as a way to do several things, for me, it was eating pushed back emotion. It was a way to hold down emotion. It was a way to keep me quiet, you know, growing up at a time when that was what you're expected to do. And it was a way to deal with boredom or frustration. I mean, almost every situation became a situation for eating. Family celebrations were all about food, and when I was bored, I would eat, and when I was angry, I would eat. So, you know, you have to learn to recognize what's going on and with your emotional being as well as your physical being, and then start having different conversations with yourself.
Now, do you know or do you have an opinion about if you want to lose weight, if fasting, juice fasting or water fasting would be a good way to jumpstart it or do at any point during the weight loss period?
I don't, you know, I did it, actually. I did a 5-day fast early on and ended up having some physical problems with that, because when you do a fast, if you don't do it correctly, you can end up killing the beneficial gut flora, which is all over the news right now. And so I ended up 2 years later finally realizing what was going on and getting onto a regimen of probiotics to sort of address that issue. But we recommend it only under strictly supervised conditions, so that, you know, you can be monitored, because it can actually be dangerous, especially for people who are on medication.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if you're on high blood pressure medication or even diabetes medication. Some of those can be really dangerous to sort of do a juice fast, because it really does change what's going on in your body when you do that.
Well, you've collected all kinds of toxins in your body, in your fat, and you're letting it go at a very accelerated rate when you're fasting, and sometimes all of that can really be overwhelming as it gets released in the blood, or as it's getting, it gets released in order to come out as you're detoxing. And I've heard all kinds of stories.
And then again, going back to the emotional thing that goes on, I mean, when you change your body's blood sugar composition level, for example, I mean, it's a mood changer. So you've got to be willing and able to pay attention to what's going on and realize that there are a couple of reasons why you're feeling what you're feeling, both physically and emotionally, and be ready for that. And so I did it with under supervision. I did it with Dr. Popper, but we didn't think about the gut flora issue until much later when I was just having problems with energy.
Mm.
So be ready for that and do it very carefully.
Yes, be ready, but don't be disappointed. Just keep on, and you want to get to your ideal weight, and the best way to do it is with these great nutrient-dense vegan foods.
And I think that's the other side of it is too that this is a long-term, for me, a lifetime thing. And so the way that I'm eating now is the way that I'm going to eat the rest of my life. And part of what people run into most of the time is they do a diet, they think they're going to do it, lose the weight, and go back to the way that they ate before. And that's not going to happen, because what happens is the weight comes back.
Right.
So you've got to find a permanent solution. And this diet, I think, is it, because the nice thing is I don't go hungry.
The food is delicious. So let's jump into your cookbook.
Sure.
And one thing I noticed about a lot of the offerings in here is they are the comfort foods that a lot of people mm-hmm. want to go to, which you don't typically see in a book that's going to encourage weight loss.
And I think that as close as I made it a goal when I started this whole project that I wanted food to taste good, and I love the food that I grew up with. I just didn't want the fat and the animal fat and the animal protein and all of that. I don't need that anymore. So there are other ways to make food taste good without that, and that's kind of what I looked for. The spices that I grew up with and those kinds of flavors and those ingredients. And, there's a cornbread stuffing in there with a baked tofu, and it's one of my favorite holiday dishes.
Oh, does that look good?
It's comfort food at its best, and the mushroom gravy is rich without fat. So it's doable and possible to have a lot of the foods that we talk about, but we can have them in a healthy way.
Yeah, so you've got pizza recipes in here and burritos,
right.
You've got a mushroom bourguignon.
And ice cream.
You've got... gnocchis, scalloped potatoes. I mean, these are things that you normally think are, even on a vegan diet, the kind of celebration occasional foods.
Yeah, but we have this thing. Take scalloped potatoes, for example. We think potatoes are this evil demon carb, bad carb. And if you listen to Dr. John McDougall and anybody else in the plant-based world, it's not the potato that's bad. It's what we do to it. By the time we soak it in fat and fry it or top it with sour cream or butter and all those things, of course it's an unhealthy food. But the potato itself is a life-giving, nutrient-dense food that's filling without being calorically dense. And so I found a way to season it and make it taste good and remind me of a dish that I grew up loving.
Okay, now let's talk about cauliflower.
Yeah, I know. Now, one of the most popular things feedback I've gotten, is about the cauliflower puree in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen all kinds of different ways to veganize or reduce fat in creams, and I've never seen cauliflower puree, and you're using it for so many different dishes in here. Amazing.
You know where it came from? I used to make this roasted cauliflower bisque, and back in the day it had oil in it, but we roasted cauliflower with shallots and whole garlic cloves and olive oil, and then pureed that all and added soy milk to it. I think I was making that vegan back then. Added soy milk to it to make a bisque. And one day I was tasting it before I had really done a lot to it, and it tasted amazing just with the cauliflower and some salt and pepper.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you could use this for a lot of things. And I can't eat a lot of soy. My body kind of doesn't tolerate it very well. So
yeah.
I was looking for other ways to have the cream sauces without the fat, and it's fat-free.
Yeah. Now, I love cauliflower just the way it is. Not raw, but I like it steamed or cooked.
Yeah, me
and it's
too.
Just delicious plain. So on one hand, I think, why would I want to do this to cauliflower? But on the other hand, it's just genius. You make mayonnaise with it and all kinds of creamy bases for soups and sauces, and it's just cauliflower.
It's just cauliflower. Yeah, I know.
And it's good for you. Cauliflower is so good for you.
It's a very healthy, healthy food. But, you know, it's also, I call it health by deception. So if you've got kids at home that just don't like to eat their vegetables,
right,
you know, puree it and sneak it in there and tell them it's cream sauce, honey. It's
right.
Cream sauce.
That, well, that's genius.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Now, you're not eating a lot of soy foods, but you do have a wonderful baked tofu recipe.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned the one that you had in that's in Virgin Vegan, and your baked tofu recipe is here in this book as well. Making your own baked tofu is the
mm-hmm.
only way to go.
Yeah. Yeah, I think most people have a bad experience with tofu in restaurants and some of the prepackaged cooked tofus that you can buy. I've been making my own tofu dishes. If I could, I would eat tofu just about every day. I love it
mm-hmm.
That much, and I've really am rarely ever disappointed by the dishes that I make with it. So it really is, and it's not that hard to do.
Exactly.
You know, if you look at this
that's
recipe,
the point. It's not
five
hard.
5 minutes to the oven. You know, that's it.
You could marinate it with anything you like and just bake it.
Yeah.
It's genius.
Yeah.
And I was hooked for a while on these baked tofus that you find in the store.
Mm-hmm.
Whole Foods has them, Trader Joe's has them. And I'm really dropping back on the amount of salt that I consume, and
mm-hmm.
those are really too salty for me.
Yeah. Well, and that's the joy of cooking for yourself is, you know, you get to choose the amount of salt. I'm kind of a guy that's not a religious cook in terms of if you don't like something about a recipe, I tend to play with recipes more than to be so strict about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how people should look at food. It makes it much more exciting.
Yeah, make it your way.
Make it your way.
I will say that the French are probably having some heart attacks over your sweet and sour ratatouille.
Well, I know. The cauliflower sauce in my first cookbook, the Forks Over Knives cookbook, is a bechamel sauce, so they're probably not speaking to me at all. and I'm unapologetic about it because, you know, if you look at the fact that 2/3 of us are having the weight problems that we're having, I think we've got to do whatever we need to do to not only make food taste good, but to make it healthy.
Well, this is the thing about French cuisine, and I think there's something really good about it, and that is when a food has a name, it's usually made a certain way.
Right.
So the traditional ratatouille is made a certain way, and it has a certain amount of ingredients, and that's it. And if you change it, then it's not ratatouille.
It's not ratatouille, yeah.
And I just made a tarte tartin, which is
uh-huh.
like an upside-down apple pie, for those of you who don't know. And I'll be posting that recipe very soon on my website. It's a treat. It's very decadent, and it's sweeter than most things that I consume, but I just had to make one, and I made it gluten-free and vegan. But I remember reading about it on some French website where it said, if you serve it with ice cream or if you serve it with whipped cream, it is no longer a tarte tartin. You cannot call it that. And they're really strict about the ingredients in food, which I can appreciate because when you're served something in France with a name, you can pretty much be guaranteed, if it's a vegan dish like ratatouille, that it's going to be that way.
Yeah.
And I always take comfort in that when I'm traveling.
Yeah, I'm probably not a popular guy in a lot of places because I believe in making everything your own.
Oh, yeah, well, that's just not French. Now, I make a cassoulet all the time, and, you know, I hear them screaming at me because my cassoulet is not a traditional meat-laden cassoulet. It's just a lovely white bean dish with a mustard sauce.
Well, the first and only cassoulet I've ever made was actually Daniel Boulud's recipe. He makes a white bean cassoulet that's vegan.
Mm.
And absolutely delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Like outside of the olive oil, I leave it alone and make it as it is. It's a very healthy dish.
Okay, let's get back to comfort food. You have a parsnip mashed potatoes recipe here. And let's just talk about parsnips for a moment.
Okay.
Parsnips don't get a lot of press.
Right.
And they
have
so much flavor.
Yeah, they have a lot of flavor. And when you're going for the fat-free thing, when you're looking to find other ways to make foods creamy, so mashed potatoes by themselves without the butter and without the cream can be a little starchy.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to find ways to cut back on that, and parsnips do a great job of it. And it adds flavor. tons of flavor to mashed potatoes. So you could do just pureed or mashed parsnips, you know, or you could add any other root vegetable you like. But they do a really good job of sort of helping the potato along.
Yeah, I'm sure you've told people to do this, but it's so good to go to a produce section, and if there are things that you don't know what they are, just bring them home and figure out what to do with them, because it'll only add so much interest and diversity, and there are a lot of interesting roots out there that can turn into some really flavorful things.
Yeah, the potato is not the only root vegetable out there. There's some amazing foods out there that deserve your attention, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, Del, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really enjoyed it, and I'm going to tell Linda I had a nice time with you.
Well, thank you for having me on. Tell Linda I said hello, and I look forward to some soup.
Okay, let's have her make you some of that, so you got to get to New York sometime.
All righty.
Okay, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, just before we go, I wanted to mention that we were talking about genetically modified food, and for all you New Yorkers out there, you might check out the campaign direct the GMO Free New York. So there's a New York genetically engineered food labeling campaign, and we really need to contact our New York Assembly members and senators to push the passage of the bill A3525 and S3835. This is really important. Wouldn't it be great if we had a law to label foods here in New York? If you need to know more about it, you can email me at info@realmeals.org or contact the New York GE Food Labeling Campaign. Other than that, thanks for listening to It's All About Food today, and have a delicious week. Bye-bye.